If we can open to Genesis 1:28 in the meantime. On the topic of leading in the marketplace, I just wanted to first build a good understanding of why we are in the marketplace. What is the purpose of work? Then to look at some useful aids in our work, what faith allows or faith provides us with to handle our work. Look at a bit about a call to work, those of us who are feeling called into the marketplace, and then what it means to lead in the marketplace, which our series on leadership, this one then touches on, and then I'll look at one or two examples. So Genesis 1 verse 28, our purpose for working. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Now, God's promise, I got this from the Covenant Theology series we did recently in the Bible College, and I realized that when Christ fulfilled all these covenants, these promises are still true to us. And when God said, "Be fruitful and multiply, subdue the earth," there's something of a bringing order from chaos that we're doing in our work. There's something of putting ourselves to productive labor that is establishing this order that God has created when we're subduing the earth. And I joke, but I kind of get a bit of a kick out of the fact that, you know, driving into the office on a Monday morning, it's not just a dreary Monday morning. I'm going to subdue the earth, you know. This is serious. This is cool. Like, I can do this. And it gives me a bit of motivation. There's really a God purpose in our work. And I would like us to, if we walk away from this knowing that there's purpose here in my work, it's not just, because when I first became a Christian, I would think to myself, well, you know, if once I'm a Christian, I mean, shouldn't I just, you know, it's just about the message. It's just about the gospel. It's just about building the church. And then what is the point? Why am I wasting all that time working when that is the message now? That is, you know, God is reaching the earth. This is the church. He's doing it through the church. You know, don't waste your time with work. But here we have subduing the earth as a role for people that God has given us. And I found great purpose in that. And I feel called into a marketplace position. I feel this is where God has placed me to use me. And we'll get to the calling a bit later, but there's something of a purpose in God for us in our work. Then I have some pointers that I got from a book that Tim Keller wrote called Every Good Endeavor. And just to help us in our work, because our culture and society messages to us so much about how we need to approach our work. There's so many messages that if we don't have a grounding in our faith, if we don't have an interpretation of how our faith works itself out in this area of our lives, we can so easily get caught up in those messages. And so I wanted to help clarify some of those and rather ground us in our faith. So let's look at how our faith helps us in our work. Although many work for money or for self-esteem, our faith means we work for a different purpose. Our faith gives us an inner ballast. Now, a ballast is used in hot air balloons to stabilize it. It's like a weight. A ballast is used in a current, electric current, to regulate the current, so you maintain a stable current. It brings stability. A ballast brings stability. They're used in ships to weigh down the ship and keep it stable through the waves. And our faith gives us an inner ballast in our work, without which work could destroy us. Because the message we get is you need to find your identity in your work. How often do we introduce ourselves as, "Hi, I'm Greg, I'm A," or they joke about accountants doing that, so that's my background as a chartered accountant. They joke about, "I'm Greg, I'm a CA." It's how will you know someone's a CA? They'll tell you. So, but it is true that a lot of us, introduce ourselves. That's the way we relate. We almost find our identity in what we've done in our work environment and what we've taken place. And what faith is telling us is to get our bearings elsewhere. You see, the problem with that is if you get your identity in that way, if you're successful, it's going to go to your head. And if you, because you'll take credit for it, won't you? If you're failing, it's going to destroy you and it's going to go to your heart. And you're going to feel wrecked because you failed and your whole identity is wrapped up in that work or that project. And what faith does is it establishes your identity outside of your work. And it allows you to look at your work a little bit from the outside as something you give yourself to in productive labor, but not something you establish an identity in. And that's squarely found in Christ. So, the next thing that your work does, that our faith does to help us in our work is it gives us a concept of the dignity and worth of all work, without which we may well get bored with our work. See, the messaging society gives us is it valorizes the great jobs, the high profile, high status, high power, save the world kind of jobs. And I recognize it's ironic because I work for a foundation that really does kind of want to save the world. But those jobs are valorized I work for a foundation focused on health and education issues on the continent. So we know we play a very small part, but you've got this big mission out there. And I know not all companies do that. But the reality is that all work has a dignity and all work has a worth. And the messaging we get is that those kind of high status, high powered jobs are valorized, and all other work is denigrated. It's seen as subpar. It's seen as less. But when we're in God, the idea of just creating a widget to help improve someone's life, the idea of putting ourselves to productive labor, by our faith, we're not taking that cue that there's no value in that. You see, our value in our work is using the gifts and abilities God has given us. There's a wonderful outworking of the gifts when we give ourselves to a productive labor, and we don't have to feel that there's no dignity or worth in our task that we give ourselves to. An example is Martin Luther, when he worked through the Psalms, he noted that the psalmist was saying, God, you fill my plate. Now, a meal didn't just arrive on that plate. You see, that food had to be prepared. There's some fairly, you might call mundane tasks, but they're tasks that we're called to do. There's subduing of the earth. There's these tasks. With this dominion came these fairly ordinary tasks, seemingly, but when we give ourselves to them, there's something of what God's purpose for us in that. What faith also does in our work is it gives us a moral compass. Now, work on its own and the framework we operate within, the legal framework that we have nowadays isn't enough, you see. It's all that kind of we're taught in tertiary education. You're not taught a moral framework. All the philosophy is how it's a relativized process. It's a morality by consensus. And our legal frameworks don't provide us with the moral standards that we need or the standards that we need to live by in order to bring about change. And when we look at this, the work that we're doing, and when we operate just with that legal framework, the duplicity of society also then, when you don't meet that moral framework, it cuts into you. It undermines the work that you're doing. But what we as Christians get through our faith is we get a moral compass that allows us not to be corrupted by our work, by just trying to test the bounds of that legal framework. You see, without that faith, you're just trying to optimize what you can do within the legal framework. And there's a higher standard, a higher calling that we have in God. For example, a lack of ruthlessness, treating people well, not trampling others on the way up. What faith also does is it gives us a new world and life view so that we're not mastered by our work. We're living for eternity. This is temporary. Our contribution here is temporary. And how you value a life then changes. The role of an educator changes when you have a faith with a new view of what a human is, of someone who you are interacting with represents, what that person represents. That's changed when we have our faith. What faith also does for our work is it gives us hope in sometimes frustrating processes and times. I think anyone who's been working for a bit of time realizes that one can go in quite idealistic and dreary-eyed maybe, but there's quite a lot of frustration in the process of our work. There's a lot of just ordinary things that can frustrate one, and sometimes one can feel like your contribution is so small. And Tim Keller spoke about the fact that he's had so much success that's come up on, you know, in the ministry, where the books have sold and all of that, but he just has to look up at New York City and realize just how much of the city's unreached and how much still needs to be done. And the response can be to be frustrated. Another example is a student studying law might have a real sense of justice and wanting to see justice come about. And then when you end up working, you get caught up in a lot of minutiae and details and bogged down in a lot of paperwork and not feeling that you're having this greater impact and bringing justice into society. And what our faith does is it gives us hope in those frustrations to know that this is fleeting. This is temporary. We're working towards a greater picture in eternity. We're working towards a true reality where all our endeavors matter forever. And I won't go into theology on inheritance now, but to just know that our work is contributing towards something far greater, not just what we see here on earth. So the next thing I wanted to go on to was to talk a bit about working out a calling for the marketplace. We've spoken about a purpose for work, why we need to work. We've spoken a bit about some tools to help us handle work. Now, one of the things that we want to work out in God is whether we're called into that area, whether we're operating in an area that we're feeling called into. And the reality of a calling, I feel, and I do feel that everyone has some specific callings that God is bringing them into. It may not always be very specific issues, but there are times when there's specifics or there are areas that God is bringing us into that he wants to use us, and he's given us gifting sovereignly. He's given us our gifting, and he wants to use us in areas. And just some thoughts around this idea of our calling. The nature of it is unique, because God's working with you as an individual. So if you are feeling called into a marketplace context, it doesn't help comparing yourself to anyone else. So for me, it doesn't help looking at a fellow chartered accountant who's succeeded in a corporate that I know and saying, oh, well, he studied for his CFA, and that's why he progressed into that channel. So let me just go study my CFA, because that's going to get me to the next step. Because all I'm doing is comparing what someone else is doing with the gifts God has placed on them. I'm not going before God, spending that time trying to understand, Lord, what gifts have you placed on my life? In what ways do I need to apply myself to work those out? So it's not a comparable thing. This is between you and God. And I'd also encourage good counsel, you know, from the elders. They can guide you. They can often see things in your life that you may not even see, and they can help you work that out. But ultimately, each one of us have been given sovereign gifts and talents, something Mark shared with us. I don't know if it was in a Sunday meeting, but he shared with us that, see, the gifts and talents you're given were sovereign. God gave them to you. So you can't take credit. And it's unique. God gave them to you. You can't take credit for what he's done through you. And it's from God, so he best knows how to work them out in you. The other point there is that it's not a linear progression where the next step is always clear. It's a faith journey. And a journey by faith is one that needs to be traveled. And as you progress, you start to understand how God's using you, understand how God's working through you and what he's bringing into your life. And there's wonderful moments of great kind of seeming revelation or illumination, like, oh, God. You know, this makes sense. There's also seasons of great frustration, seemingly, thinking I'm just plodding on, but then draw from God, draw from his word, and continue to work out that security and peace that you have heard God and that you're walking in his purposes. You see, the Western culture we live in is so individualized that we can be so preoccupied with self-actualization that we forget that we need to look beyond ourselves to find our true purpose. You see, God's knitted us into community. He's put us here for a purpose that's beyond ourselves. And that's when we really find our meaning in him, when we start to live beyond our own needs and wants. Then I wanted to talk a little bit about having understood this, being equipped for work, understanding if we're called to become a leader in the marketplace, which is, I guess, to build up to where the series is. I think some things that allow us to be leaders in our vocation, one important factor is that God really wants to develop our character. And without character, we can't effectively lead, because leadership by nature is taking, if you're leading, you're bringing people through, and it requires great character to do that. And in order to build that character, God has to work on your character. And we need to allow him, you see, we need to allow him and not be too bitter or resentful or difficult or hide our flaws so much. We need to expose ourselves to God, and we now allow him to minister and allow him to work on us. The other point I wanted to make is we need to actively develop our gifting so we've got something meaningful to contribute. We're in a position to add value in the environment we find ourselves in. I think God's given all of us gifts, and those gifts need to be honed and refined to be able to apply them into a context. And I use the example of my wife, Pauline. She has a great logic mind. She has a great maths brain. But if she didn't study the work she had to study, she wouldn't be able to know how to apply that in a context where she can now do the work she does to they're currently developing a cancer drug that's being patented. So she wouldn't be able to make that contribution if she hadn't applied herself and developed her giftings. And it's no good her saying, well, you know, my brother's really good and he's creative, so, you know, that looks like a good channel. But it's, as I touched on earlier, it's working out those giftings and developing them. And then now she's effectively able to lead in the field that she's in. The other point is to stay open to learning and to new challenges. Because a leader will take people to places where they haven't been before. The fourth point is to understand that we'll, as Christians, we'll often find ourselves viewing things in a way that's counterculture. I want to touch on the example of Daniel just now, but he's, by nature of us being called out ones, the ecclesia, We're not of this world. We're in this world, and we're there to be salt and to be light. And it doesn't mean we remove ourselves from that situation unless it's harmful, unless it's actually problematic. But we're in that situation, and we've got a position that is now counter the prevailing culture. And when we recognize that, we can see where sometimes we just aren't going with the flow. And it's not because you're being difficult, it's because you've got a different position, you're rooted in faith. And so that can work itself out in a range of ways. The fifth point I wanted to make is in leading, sometimes despite our frailty as Christian, God will continue to use us. So what we can do is we can succumb to our frailty almost and start to say, you know, God, I've messed up so much that I'm just going to write off the idea of you using me. Or I've just closed myself off to that for so long. What we have to realize is that God is using us. You really have to actually acknowledge that sometimes. You have to have faith that God is using you. And he uses us in different ways. He can use us to influence personal decisions people make for him. And it may not be taking someone from knowing nothing about God through to actually knowing and him personally and putting their faith in him because of everything you've been able to expose them to and teach them. You may be helping them, encouraging them, showing them by example in your life, and they may be becoming more open to that idea for their lives. You are influencing people in your work context when you are exposing them to your work, to your walk in Christ. You are leading. Some people are privileged to make to be able to influence organizational decisions. They're in a position of a degree of authority or control where they're able to influence the direction in which an organization moves, and that's obviously another form of leadership. And then I wanted to say another way of leading is we add moral fiber into the DNA of whichever organization we're in or whichever context we find ourselves in. You as a Christian, being rooted in faith, you actually have something because you're taking your bearings from somewhere else. You're contributing to the moral fiber of a place. When you're there, you're leading them morally. You'll be surprised how many times almost like a moral bearing is taken from you because you have a plumb line, you have a compass which you're following. You're not led by the law. Obviously, you're in Christ, but you've established that in your life, and people take a bearing from that. The sixth point is in leading is to embrace our call to excellence. Embracing our call to excellence at what is good, how we're called to that. And it's not something to be ashamed of. And I think if you're driven by the right things, you're putting the right fuel in, the caring for others, love for others, you're not driven by inadequacy or need to prove yourself to others, then that call to excellence will take you up to the edge, but you won't go over. You're not going to burn out because you're driven by the right things. If you're driven by the wrong things, because you're finding your identity in that work, or you've got an inadequacy that you're trying to prove yourself through your work, you'll push yourself over that edge. So to embrace that call to excellence in the right context. And then my last point is that in working on these areas, in working on our gifting, in working on our character, in working on staying open, in being open to new challenges, understanding how God can use us, understanding that we're counterculture. The way we would be leading is not through profile necessarily, through titles, but it's a leadership by example as a Christian. We're leading by example, and that's leadership in the marketplace. You know, sometimes it's recognized, and sometimes it may not even be recognized, but leadership in the marketplace isn't a title. It's an example that you're setting, and sometimes it can be recognized, and sometimes it isn't. The example of Daniel going counterculture, I wanted to just highlight it now. If you can go with me to Daniel 2, verse 12. For those who don't know, I have two kids, and our boy is named Daniel. And Daniel, the name means God is my judge. So it just sets the tone right there. How it's quite a big name to live up to. But it sets the tone that God is sovereign in his life. time do you normally end? 7:30. Am I good? Got lots of time. Great. So, Daniel 2. Oh, I should go back up. Let's go back up to verse 6. Verse 5. Go to verse 4. So let's set some context. Daniel had a way, when he went counterculture, because he took his bearing from God, we were in a context. Let's just draw the setting. The Israelites had been brought into Babylon, and the technique that the Babylonians were using to basically quell the risk of an uprising was to assimilate the Israelites into Babylonian culture. They were taking the best and the brightest out of the Israelites, and they were putting them through a 3-year intensive course, and they were basically teaching them about the things of Babylon, the literature. They're helping them forget their Israelite background. They were assimilating them into their culture, making them loyal to the Babylonian authorities through their training, and basically bringing them into part of the government, giving them status, significance in this Babylonian society, so they think, that's not too bad. No, it's actually quite nice. Why fight this? So we found Daniel in this context where he's being assimilated, but he was awake to the pressures that were being placed on him that didn't line up with his faith. See, sometimes it's the story about the toad and the pot. And if you gradually heat up the pot, the toad has no understanding that it's getting hotter and hotter. C.S. Lewis talks about us not even knowing that we're being carried along by the tide of the sinful world until we put our feet on the riverbed. Only then do you feel the pressure of the river busy striking against your feet. Now, Daniel was able to feel that pressure. He was awake to it, and he resolved not to defile himself when they were wanting to give them all the food that was presented to the Babylonians. He knew that those meats, for some reason, had been somehow defiled, and he didn't want to defile himself. So the way he addressed this need to be counterculture was he combined courtesy with decisiveness. He was courteous in his request, but he was decisive, and he resolved that he didn't want to adopt these pagan ways. He wasn't aggressive or insulting, and he behaved with great courtesy. And he said, he asked the authority if he could have 10 days of just eating the vegetables, not the meat, and then they were to just look at them again, and if they looked any less healthy than the others, then, you know, go back to the way things were. But if you could just give us those 10 days, he trusted that God would look after them, and God came through. And they were able to stop eating this defiled meat, and he was able to stand for what he believed in this context, in a secular context. So that's the build up. We've had an example of Daniel trusting God, God coming through, him operating counterculture once before, and then we get into Daniel 2 verse 4 and 5. So I'm going to just start reading from there. Then the Chaldeans said to the king in Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream and we will show the interpretation." See, the king had had a dream and he called all the sorcerers and magicians to come and tell him what that dream meant because it was so startling. King answered and said to the Chaldeans, "The word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, shall be torn from limb to limb." He's quite an aggressive king. "And your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor." So the king is shrewd. He doesn't just want to allow them to interpret the dream and pull the wool over his eyes. He's saying, no, okay, I want the dream and the interpretation so I can make sure that you're operating in the supernatural. So their response was, they answered a second time and said, "Let the king tell his servants the dream, then we'll show you the interpretation." They were struggling here now. The king answered and said, "I know with certainty that you are trying to gain time because you see that the word from me is firm. If you do not make the dream known to me, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words about me till the times change. Therefore tell me the dream and I shall show you that and I shall know that you can show me its interpretation. The Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand, for no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. Because of this, the king was angry and very furious and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill him. So now we have Daniel, who's established himself in the secular context. He's counterculture. Was that me moving around? No. Okay. And he's now in a position where, outside of a church context, in the world, he's operating in faith, and he's saying, God, I'm going to trust you to come through. He's seen God come through before. He's seen God make sure that they were healthy and well without eating these meats. He's made sure, he knows that God will come through for him. And what he does here is amazing. And I think it's the next point about that being up for a new challenge, or being open to step out in faith. Because of this, verse 12, the king was angry and very furious and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon to be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree of the king so urgent? Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. So now you got a guy, he knows God has gifted him, but he doesn't have this interpretation. He's got a king that's about to tear them limb from limb. And his knee-jerk reaction was to trust God and say, tell the king to make an appointment, give me an opportunity to give him an interpretation. But he didn't have that interpretation at the time. He was operating in a place of faith. He was trusting that God would come through for him. Then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. The mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. You see, God came through for him. He trusted God. God came through for him in a profound way. And it's from this moment, this vision that Nebuchadnezzar had, of this image of a man with a golden head and bronze, silver chest and arms, the middle and thighs of bronze, and the legs of iron, and how these each represented different kingdoms that would follow, the gold being the Babylonians, the silver being the Persians, the thighs the Greeks, and the feet of iron and clay, and this stone that's hewn from no human hand, coming and smashing down these kingdoms, decimating them into shards that get carried away by the wind, and you have the stone becoming a great mountain, and how this represented the different kingdoms that were to follow. And then in the middle of the Roman kingdom, Christ would come as a stone, and he would decimate the kingdoms that came before, and he would establish this mighty mountain that no earthly kingdom could challenge. And that came from Daniel, that interpretation came from Daniel trusting God in this context, operating with the king in the government. And what we need to do is have faith that God will use our gifts in our work context, in our marketplace context. We need to trust that God will use us. And we've got great examples of how God used Daniel. I want to look at Joseph too. He's another man who operated in a way that was profound. He had both natural gifting and supernatural gifting, and he was able to use them both. You see, Joseph He also had some, I guess, what I want to call some character issues to work out. When God gave him a vision with his brothers, his knee-jerk reaction was to blurt out that vision to his brothers, and that made them very angry, even though what that vision was establishing was his superiority and that they would be bowing down, these sheaves of wheat would be bowing down to his sheep. And his response was to then anger his brothers by telling them this dream that he had been given. But later Joseph was taken by the Ishmaelites when his brothers had thrown him in the pit. They'd taken him off to Egypt. In Egypt, he'd become a servant to Potiphar. And when Potiphar's wife tried to seduce him, his response was that my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put me in charge of everything that he has. He's not greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself. And his response was no. He could not. And she obviously continued, and he ran away. So he developed character over this time. He got to a point where he interpreted dreams for the cupbearer and for the king's bread maker in jail. And then he used those gifts God had given him. Later on, 2 years later, the king, Pharaoh, had a dream that he didn't know how to interpret. At that point, the cupbearer remembered old Joseph stuck there in jail, and he called on him. And Joseph interpreted the picture that the king had, the Pharaoh had, of the 7 years of fat cows, the seven lean cows. And what the king did is, the Pharaoh did is, he said, no one has that kind of wisdom. I'm going to put you in charge here. Through those gifts God had given Joseph, he was put in charge. And he had an incredible gift of administration. And he was able to oversee all of the land of Egypt at the time. He responded to that famine by storing up all of that grain into the storehouses in each city and then selling it back during those years of famine to the people of Egypt, basically gaining great wealth for the Pharaoh, after which, once all the money was used up and the famine was so severe, lasting 7 years, the people were forced, they said, we'll sell our land to you. We'll sell ourselves to you. Whatever grain you get, actually one-fifth of that also must come into Pharaoh. So Joseph established this incredible asset base for the Pharaoh. He used his gifting in a secular context. God had placed these gifts in his life, and with this process won incredible favor, and his family came and joined him. But how we need to develop that character to be able to be an effective leader, I think that we can get from Joseph's story. We can get from Joseph's story how in the marketplace God can use our supernatural gifts of the Spirit, and our natural gifts that we have and that he's placed in us that we need to develop and hone. And I don't think you could administer that kind of amount of assets unless you had developed those skills. So just to encourage you that leadership in the marketplace is multifaceted, and I think Christian leadership is established from being an example. And that's it.